This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, the 1st of August, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. President Bush appoints John Bolton as ambassador to the United Nations, bypassing the Senate process. Hate crimes are on the rise in Tampa Bay, Florida.
History shows us that when that anti-gay rhetoric by elected officials and religious leaders increases, so do hate crimes against gay people.
And former rebel leader John Garang is killed in a helicopter crash. We'll hear about his legacy. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. France has deported two radical Muslim preachers and says it will kick out more by the end of the month as governments across Europe tighten security in the wake of last month's London bombings. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
On Friday, France deported Algerian Reda Amahoud 17 days after his arrest in an anti-terrorist swoop. And on July the 23rd, another Algerian, Abdelhamid Aissaoui, was thrown out of the country. Amahoud, who had entered the country illegally, was accused of having called for holy war at a mosque supposed to be a centre for hardline Islamists. His brother Abdurrahman is in jail for helping the murderers of Afghan Mujahid leader Ahmad Shah Massoud. Aissaoui, who only preaches occasionally, had already served 4 years for his alleged part in a plot to blow up a train. Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy, who likes to talk tough on security questions, said that about 10 radical imams will be deported before the end of August. Police say that about 40 mosques in France are influenced by the hardline Salafist version of Islam, while Sarkozy says that 12 are under surveillance. The minister says that he'll strip those who have become French of their citizenship. France has the largest Muslim population in Europe. New laws are being drafted to allow deportation for incitement to discrimination, hatred or violence against an individual or a group, as well as streamlining action against those accused of terrorism. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Iran says they will restart work at a main nuclear plant today because of a missed deadline by the European Union to offer incentives for them to dismantle their nuclear program. The European Union says they will offer a package in the next couple of days. The United States says they will urge the United Nations to impose sanctions if Iran restarts their nuclear program. The International Atomic Energy Agency urged Iran to hold off until a proposal is offered by the EU. Nuclear Six Nation talks are stagnant at the end of the seventh day, but negotiations are continuing. Severine Bordeaux has more from Beijing.
The six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear program are still under their way in Beijing, but the seventh day of discussions hasn't yet allowed the parties to reach an agreement. A second draft of a potential joint statement has been submitted today by China and will be further discussed tomorrow. But the United States and North Korea disagree about the definition of denuclearization. Washington wants Pyongyang to dismantle all its nuclear programs, including the civil ones, while North Korea only agrees to consider the dismantlement of military ones. And the joint statement will most probably not refer to the crucial question of the timing of dismantlement, which is also a strong point of disagreement between the two main parties. All countries involved in the discussions are still struggling to find a common ground to put the basis for further discussions. No time limit has yet been put on the third round of discussions, the longest one since this nuclear crisis started in October 2002. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Beijing.
According to international emails made available to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, the United States Air Force prosecutors had grave concerns about the fairness of military trials against alleged terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Ben Friedland has more from D.C.
Two senior United States Air Force prosecutors objected to their supervisors about the fairness of war crimes military commissions being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. According to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, Captain John Carr wrote to the chief prosecutor that the members of the commission had been handpicked to ensure convictions. He also complained that exculpatory evidence was being withheld for security reasons. Additionally, Major Robert Presson wrote to another senior officer that he could not vow that the commissions would be, quote, full and fair. Following the emails, an investigation launched by the Pentagon's Inspector General found no evidence to support the two officers' claims. The chief prosecutor contacted by Captain Carr called the accusations monstrous lies. However, later the accusations were simply characterized as miscommunication, misunderstanding, and personality conflicts. The two prosecutors requested that they be reassigned, and new counsel has been issued. The Bush administration hopes to restart military commissions next month. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ben Friedland.
The first ever government study reveals insight into rampant sexual violence in the prison system. The Department of Justice's Bureau of Statistics interviewed prison officials at 8,600 prisons. The report shows that in 2004, 2,100 instances of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, and sexual abuse, have been confirmed, but that more than 8,000 are alleged, and 55% of the violence was conducted by prison staff. The first ever report is required by the Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003. Luisa Stano is acting director of Stop Prisoner Rape. She says the DOJ report is a good first step, but it only includes a fraction of the cases.
This report only analyzes formal complaints filed by inmates. And we know from our daily contacts with survivors of prisoner rape that most, both men and women, who are sexually abused in U.S. prisons and jails never file a formal complaint.
Next year, the Department of Justice will question 60,000 inmates under anonymity to get a more accurate account of sexual violence. I'm Leanne Caldwell from WPFW in Washington, D.C.
President Bush appointed John Bolton as the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations today, bypassing the Senate confirmation process where Bolton's nomination has been stalled for months. Bolton will serve as ambassador for the remainder of the current Congress that ends in January 2007. Critics say that by bypassing the Senate, Bolton's legitimacy has been damaged. FSRN's Mitch Jezerich has more.
With Senate Democrats having stalled the nomination of John Bolton, President Bush put Bolton into the UN while Congress was on recess through what is called a recess appointment, which allows the president to bypass Senate confirmation while Congress is out of town.
America has now gone more than 6 months without a permanent ambassador to the United Nations. This post is too important to leave vacant any longer, especially during a war and a vital debate about UN reform.
It's the 106th recess appointment made by President Bush since taking office, and it's the first time since 1948 that a U.S. ambassador to the UN did not receive Senate confirmation. While most Republicans praised the move, Senate Democrats called it an abuse of power. Bolton will serve as ambassador until the end of the current Congress, which concludes in January of 2007. Bolton spoke briefly at the White House announcement.
We seek a stronger, more effective organization, true to the ideals of its founders, and agile enough to act in the 21st century.
However, critics worry about Bolton's view of the UN that were expressed in statements like this one made 10 years ago.
I'm sorry, the United States makes the UN work when it wants it to work. And that is exactly the way it should be, because the only question for the United States is what's in our national interest. And if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that is the fact.
Bolton will make it to the UN just in time for a major conference on reform scheduled in September. President Bush's list of changes he wants to see includes addressing bureaucratic corruption, making Japan a permanent member of the Security Council, and limiting the membership of the UN Human Rights Commission to keep out countries that allegedly violate human rights. Don Kraus with Citizens for Global Solutions, which runs the website StopBolton.org, says the U.S. is on the right track with its desired changes, but he worries that Bolton will derail any potential progress.
On the run-up to this recess appointment, Bolton was already calling for more office space here in Washington so he could play that role in setting an agenda. In this past, in his role as the Undersecretary of State, he went around really trying to create policy, and much of the policy that he pursued was, there was not consensus within the administration.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
At least 24 people died in protests in Sudan's capital of Khartoum today, following the death of the country's vice president, John Garang. Garang, a former Sudanese rebel leader who signed a peace deal ending the country's 20-year civil war, was killed in a helicopter crash near the Uganda border while returning from a visit to the country. Rioters burned cars and threw stones after Garang's body was found this weekend. Some southern Sudanese are suspicious about the circumstances surrounding Garang's death, but Sudanese leaders are calling for calm, promising the nation's peace process will remain on track. Joshua Chialimpa takes a look at the leader's legacy, beginning with a speech Garang gave earlier this year.
Compatriots, fellow countrymen and women, congratulations. This is the Christmas and New Year's gift for the Sudanese people, to our region, and to Africa for 2005. As this agreement will engulf the country in democratic and fundamental transformation instead of being engulfed in wars as it has always been for the last 184 years since 1821, when our country was first invaded by outside powers and exposed to the ravages of the slave trade and predatory commerce of all sorts.
John Garang, the charismatic leader of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement and Army, for 21 years, led a rebel movement against the Khartoum government to save the people of southern Sudan from domination by the Arab North. He combined his intellect and charisma to lead a movement against all odds. In January this year, a peace deal was signed that would end the fighting and set a new political dispensation in Africa's largest country. Under the agreement with the Khartoum government, Garang would become the vice president of Sudan for an interim period of 5 years, after which a referendum would be held on the self-determination of the South from the North. He was sworn in as vice president only 3 weeks ago and was killed in a plane crash while coming from a private visit to an old friend, President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, on Saturday. A Sudanese diplomat in Kampala, His Excellency Mohamed Issa Ismail, described the late Dr. John Garang as an example of peace ambassador, not only in the region, but the whole of the African continent.
He was a person committed to peace in Sudan, and he was very known in Sudan, especially in the south, as a leader for the southerners, and later on became as a leader to the whole Sudan. After his commitment and resolute, together with our Vice President, Sayyid Ali Osman Muhammad Taha, they did a profound job and a pioneer job in setting peace and tranquility in Sudan. This is a very big achievement that has been done by the late Dr. John Garang, bringing peace that is now considered as a model, not only in the region, but to the whole Africa.
John Garang was a PhD holder in agricultural economics from the State University of Iowa, United States. But this did not stop him from spending most of his life in the bushes of southern Sudan, fighting for the freedom of his people. But his rebel movement, the SPLA, has also been accused of human rights abuses and causing the death of thousands of people in southern Sudan. John Garang is accused of not tolerating anyone who disagreed with him, and this is likely to cause a power vacuum after his demise. He was a frequent visitor to Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, an old student at Dar es Salaam University, and this was a cause of animosity between Uganda and the Sudan. It is not surprising, therefore, that when he died, he was coming from Kampala and in President Yoweri Museveni's helicopter, together with the president's pilot, Major Nyakairu, and seven others of President Yoweri Museveni's flight crew. Both Uganda and the Sudan have declared 3 days of mourning, and what remains unanswered is if the peace process will remain on track after the death of Dr. John Garang, commonly known as Comrade Garang. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The debate over Iraq's constitution continued this weekend, and the drafting committee announced today it would have the constitution finished in time to meet an August 15 deadline. Members of the government heard a presentation this weekend on the refilling of Iraq's southern marshes, part of which have been refilled after being drained of water in the 1990s. FSRN's David Enders has more.
Near the city of Chubaish, about a half hour north of Basra, a young boy pulls a canoe-like boat through the marshes between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. It was around the marshes that ancient civilization thrived in Mesopotamia. Not far away are the ruins of Ur, a Sumerian trading center built 5,000 years ago. In the 1980s and 90s, the marshes became a center of resistance against Saddam Hussein's government. The government diverted water from the area, destroying a number of villages and burned as much as 90% of the marshes, displacing at least 350,000 people who subsisted largely by fishing, raising water buffalo, and harvesting the reeds native to the area, from which they also built their houses. In April 2003, NGOs and the Ministry of Water Resources began reflooding the marshes, and water has been returned to somewhere between 50 and 40% of the estimated 12,000 to 15,000 square kilometers that were drained. The plan was carried out haphazardly, with residents in some places cutting through roads to allow water flow. The reeds have returned, as well as some of the wildlife, and so have as many as 70,000 people, but not all have come back because of a desire to return to old modes of existence. Haria Shuin left the marshes in the 1990s and moved to Musayib, about an hour south of Baghdad. Her family became farmers, but they moved back to the marshes 2 months ago because of violence in the area, often directed at Shiite Muslims.
There's no electricity, no water, no schools.
Others say they are not interested in returning to their former way of life. Mutluk Saleh Hassan, the head of the Albuswila tribe, once lived by fishing, herding, and hunting birds. His family left the marshes in the 1980s, but returned in 1997. He and his sons work as day laborers in a nearby town, and are living in an area that was once underwater. The area is among the poorest in the country, and residents place 55-gallon barrels on the side of the main road like mailboxes, filled each day by a water tanker. The man who agreed to take this journalist to the marshes insisted on carrying a gun to ensure safety, and was careful to make sure these people understood that the journalist was in no way related to an American NGO that the villagers said had made promises of reconstruction, but with which they had not had contact in months.
We went to the government and asked them to build a dam so that our land won't be flooded. They sent it to Baghdad, and the government said we would have a dam, but they have not built it. We want the water to be back, but we want proper housing.
Azam Al-Alwash is the head of Eden Again, a project dedicated to refilling the marshes. Trained as a civil engineer, Awash emigrated from Iraq to the U.S. when he was 20, but when he was growing up, he traveled to the marshes with his father. He returned to Iraq shortly after the invasion, and now employs 60 Iraqis on the project, which has extensively studied the current reflooding and has developed a plan for the reflooding of the entire area, as well as the building of villages. Azam's plan has come into conflict with a Ministry of Agriculture plan drawn up in the 1980s for the irrigation of some of the land that has been cleared, but he says the plan is ill-conceived.
If there is political will to restore the marshes, we can restore the entire marshes. People who tried to plant in the reclaimed marshes in 94, 95, 96, when they first planted, everything grows until the roots hit the groundwater table and they die. Because the groundwater table is salty. It basically, it burns. They call it yahrik al-zara. In fact, you see them right now, instead of harvesting, they let their cattle eat. It's free grass. So, people who tell you we want to plant in the marshes, I am predicting that they're going to die a slow economic death.
From Chubaish in Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
By 2 p.m. Central Time, all 120 members of the Pastors for Peace caravan had successfully crossed the U.S.-Mexico border after a one-and-a-half-hour customs process. And this time, nothing was confiscated from the group. Part of the Pastors for Peace travel challenge involves bringing back an item to challenge the rules against the blockade. This year, the group carried four books, including a Cuban constitution, a report on optometry programs being performed by Cuban doctors in Venezuela, and one on evangelical movements and churches in Cuba. Though the caravanistas today reported a surprisingly smooth process, Reverend Lucius Walker, founder of Pastors for Peace, says people were pressed by customs agents to sign additional forms and were probed about what they did during their stay in Cuba.
They're attempting to intimidate and to violate the constitutional rights of the caravanistas by asking for more information than they have a right to ask. So everybody is asserting their constitutional rights. It's going to be a slow process because we won't just fold and give them all the answers to all of those questions about who, when, where, why, what we did in Cuba, naming names. No way.
Four video cameras monitored the group in the interview room, and roughly 20 Customs and Homeland Security Border Patrol agents took photographs of people while being interviewed. 43 boxes of aid confiscated from the group last week are still being held by U.S. Customs under the direction of the Department of Commerce. 20 congressional representatives have lent their support to try to free the aid, including Charles Rangel, Sheila Jackson Lee, and Lydia Velasquez. By a vote of 65 to 31, the U.S. Senate passed a bill prohibiting civil liability suits from being initiated or continued against the firearms industry. If passed by the House and signed by the President, this legislation will protect firearm and ammunition manufacturers, distributors, dealers, and importers paying damages resulting from the misuse of their products. D.C. Radio Co-op's Ram Katkuda reports on efforts mobilizing against the bill, challenging its constitutionality.
I do not have the words to describe the unbearable pain of losing my child. I can only ask the Senate, please, do not make this mother's pain worse.
Despite the plea of people who, like Maria Michaels, have lost loved ones to street violence, in their last act before a month-long August recess, 65 United States senators last week supported blocking civil liability lawsuits against firearms and ammunition manufacturers and dealers in a bipartisan effort encouraged by the White House.
This legislation is shafting the little guy.
Peter Hamm, the director of communication of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, says they have been fighting this bill for 7 years now, united with the Million Mom March.
This battle will be won by our side. It's only a matter of when.
Gun violence victims in this country are being injured because of the negligence of gun dealers, adds Hamm. This has inspired 33 municipalities and one state attorney general to bring suit against the industry. Seeking to recoup expenses attributed to gun violence, they were assisted by gun control advocates motivated to bankrupt the industry in tactics similar to the attacks on the tobacco industry. But while the United States is engaged in wars abroad under the Bush administration, it is hardly the time to oppose the gun industry, and you could hear it from the Senate floor. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah.
There are millions of guns out there in the underworld that people can get. But that doesn't justify holding liable gun manufacturers who, if they all go broke, we won't have the guns for our soldiers, when somebody takes one of their guns and misuses it. The person misusing it ought to be liable, not the gun manufacturer.
In his statements, the senator echoed the arguments of the NRA, who threw in the weight of its 4 million members and a lot of money, and managed to bring in support letters from the Department of Defense and the Executive Office of the President. They all talked about how this bill would help safeguard United States national security and protect an industry that employs thousands of people against lawsuits which they claim risk to bankrupt it. The National Rifle Association hailed that, quote, freedom prevailed, and applauded the Senate's passage of the measure. Meanwhile, opponents led by the Brady campaign complain that this would diminish incentives for distribution and safer designs.
It certainly raises important constitutional questions that Congress would attempt to single out one industry and immunize them from liability, in this case when they supply guns to criminals.
Daniel Weiss, staff attorney of the Legal Action Project of the Brady Center, adds that holding the distributors accountable has worked in the past.
Two New Jersey police officers were shot and severely wounded, lost their livelihoods in the line of duty when two people walked into a West Virginia gun shop. The man pointed to a dozen cheap junk guns he wanted. The woman then said, by the way, I'm the buyer. Run the background check only on me. The pawn shop gladly sold the guns. We filed a lawsuit on behalf of the officers, and the gun store settled. Other gun dealers in the area around that gun shop also changed their business practices.
We should keep pushing for different priorities on the Hill, says Linda Leakes of Empower DC.
We know when profit is involved, it's tough to fight that. Guns are specifically made to kill people, and there's no need to have a product that is out there to kill people.
Rim Katkhuda of the DC Radio Co-op.org reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A gay man's home was set on fire in an apparent hate crime in Polk County, Florida. About 1 month ago, the neighboring Hillsborough County Commission banned county participation in or acknowledgement of gay pride. Now, Tampa Bay area community members are afraid that local residents are taking their cues from increasingly bigoted public officials, and there may be more violence to come. From WMNF, Andrew Stelzer reports.
The words "die fag" were spray-painted on the front steps of this home that was torched.
Brian Winfield is the communications director of Equality Florida. The statewide group has increasingly been in the media spotlight as bias against gays has increased. The latest incident was on July 25th when the home of Paul Day was set on fire. Day returned to his mobile home with his boyfriend to find he had been burglarized and a flammable liquid had been poured on the smoldering house. But he told Patrick Jones with Polk County Equality that it wasn't the first time he had been targeted in the mobile home park because he was gay.
He's reported to the owners of the place itself that he's been harassed at times. Even the maintenance personnel admitted, yes, that he's even heard people calling him faggot and everything else to Paul itself, but still nothing was done.
The fire department in the town of Lakeland, about 30 miles outside of Tampa, is investigating the incident and hasn't released any details. Jones says he's frustrated at the speed of the investigation, that no public official will call it a hate crime, and that it took 4 days before even local media reported the story.
We're worried about terrorism around the world, around the country, but this is terrorism in our own backyard. This is not a gay issue. This is a human rights issue.
In Florida, more than 20% of all hate crimes in 2003 were motivated by the victim's sexual orientation, the highest proportion since the state began recording the category. According to statistics from the state attorney general, 2002 and 2003 saw a higher number of hate crimes due to sexual orientation than any other year in over a decade. Winfield says there's an obvious connection to the anti-gay marriage movement that's sweeping the country and will likely be considered in Florida in 2006.
Lakeland is also home to the church that is sponsoring Florida's anti-gay, anti-family constitutional amendment to limit marriage only to straight couples. And we can't help but to recognize the similarity that in a community where the leaders of such an anti-gay battle call home, it's also the same community where people feel comfortable with their bigotry, so much so that they're willing to act it out in violent ways.
Polk County has one of the highest populations of same-sex senior citizen couples in the country, but Winfield says last week's events may do more to cause fear than to bring out vocal opposition.
In many ways, it's an act that terrorizes an entire community. So by spray painting die fag and setting people's home on fire, it's not just a message to these two individuals, but to any gay and lesbian citizen of Lakeland or of Florida for that matter, that you're not wanted, that if we know that you're gay, if you're out of the closet, your life is at risk. And that has a real terrorizing effect on people.
During the month of June, events in Hillsborough County created space in the newspaper for people to write letters to the editor against homosexuality, which Jones says has given momentum to bigoted views in the Tampa Bay area.
You know, especially what's going on in Hillsborough County with their county commissioners, you know, with no human rights ordinance over in there in that area, you know, it makes you wonder what levels, if it's going to be stepped up in this area.
In an effort to reach out to Central Florida residents, the city of Key West is holding a Gay Pride in Exile festival later this month, but Winfield believes it will take more than a couple of days of healing to turn the cultural tide.
We need to begin a process by which our political and religious leaders step away from using this anti-gay rhetoric that becomes so popular in order to build one's base, because we know, history shows us, that when that anti-gay rhetoric by elected officials and religious leaders increases, so do hate crimes against gay people.
For FSRN, from WMNF Radio in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Zimba Russo. Our headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, McMillan, and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.